Welcome to everybody. It's fun to sit in the front sometimes and just, you know, it's really funny when you sit in a place you're not accustomed to sitting. The viewpoint changes and probably the mind changes too. So I found one of the best ways to learn something that you don't know too much about is to find yourself having to teach it. And so when Birgette asked me to teach tonight, I spent a long time saying, I can't think what to teach about. I can't make up my mind. I'm of two minds. I might do this, I might do that. And then I realized, I think what I'm ready to teach about is the mind. So for a long time, I've avoided, any time I teach as part of an introductory series, avoided that one particular teaching about the mind, because I didn't really know what it was, and I thought maybe it was so esoteric that you had to have a lot more practice than I have. So I decided, okay, well, that's what I'm going to teach, the mind. And so I've spent some time reading and practicing with it and listening about it, and I think I've learned some things. So I'm going to see what I can share with you and see if you can learn some things too. So a few years ago in the jail meditation class, Melissa was a student who wondered about this. And one day I was teaching along about wise speech, and Melissa's hand went up. Miss Margaret, what's the difference between the brain and the mind? She asked me. And I thought, well, okay, that's actually not too hard. So I said something like, I don't, of course, remember exactly, something like, well, the brain is something that we can touch and we can feel and we can see. But, you know, mind, we can't directly see it, we can't directly touch it. And she seemed satisfied with that, so I went back to teaching wise speech. But, of course, in a minute, Miss Margaret, yes, Melissa. She said, Miss Margaret, what's the difference between the mind and the soul? Is there a difference? And are they the same? And I thought, okay then. I wasn't prepared for that question, but I answered what I thought and I think it was the truth, and that is that philosophers and theologians and scientists, as well as ourselves, have been wondering and debating about this for centuries. And they haven't come up with an answer yet. And so I told her, I don't have an answer for you on that one. And she was actually satisfied with that. But I use her wondering to illustrate the fact that we all, I think all of us, wonder about the mind. And so my first question preparing tonight's talk became, how does Buddhist teaching see the mind? And how does it understand consciousness? The Pali Abhidhamma is a complex set of Buddhist teachings, much expanded after the Buddha's time, about mind and body experiences. It says, consciousness itself is unbelievably quickly recurring sequence of simple events. You may or may not believe this, but this is what's presented in what we call the scripture. Each event is a momentary cognizing of a sense object by means of a sense organ. The eye sees a recorder. The ear hears a car. That each one of those is one event. This results in an event of seeing, hearing, thinking, lots of thinking, tasting, touching, smelling. Remember that thinking is considered to be a sense in the Buddhist understanding. So each one of these events follows one another in a continual process. And the process is what we recognize as consciousness. But a moment of consciousness never arises without a number of what are called mental factors. In the Abhidhamma, in fact, it lists 52 possible mental factors. I don't know how they counted, but people who watch their minds agree with this, actually. An example of a mental factor would be something that colors just the simple cognizing of eye and object, a feeling tone about it, a sense of greed or energy or worry or rapture. an example I thought of is if I go into my friend's house and I see a beautiful painting, that's eye contact. But immediately with that eye contact might arise appreciation. If I think it's wonderful, I also the next moment might be a sense of envy. If I think, oh, she doesn't deserve that. She doesn't appreciate it like I do. I should own that. Greed. So the simple eye contact brings up other factors, one after the other. Not every factor is present with every moment of consciousness. They arise in these combinations just due to the conditions. And these factors color each one of these events, each of our experiences in some way. But because typically one event of consciousness follows another so rapidly, it is this stream that we feel is the sense of self. We call it stream of consciousness, the following of event after event after event, and we don't see spaces in between it, typically. That's what we perceive as stream of conscious. We perceive it as self, or me, or myself. So the stream of consciousness that we perceive as me is a continual presentation of separate events. And what I perceive as me is a process, not an entity, not a thing. Believe it or not, it's in the scripture. This is how it's presented. In recent years, the Satipatthana Sutta, the Foundations of Mindfulness Sutta, has become the sort of supporting structure for teaching about mindfulness in this Vipassana world that we practice in. The word Satipatthana can be translated, interpreted as foundation or presence, and meaning of mindfulness. Bhikkhu Bodhi says about this sutta, it is definitive in presenting the Buddha's unique approach to meditation. What the Buddha shows in this sutta is the tremendous but generally hidden power inherent in mindfulness, a power that can unfold all the mind's potentials. So in the sutta, there are four foundations of mindfulness. Mindfulness of body, of feeling tone, of mind and mental states, and what's called mindfulness of dhammas, which means mindfulness of any object of mind. And if you want to explore the whole sutta, Joseph Goldstein has a book called Mindfulness, A Practical Guide to Awakening. It's a very readable presentation of the sutta. Tonight, I am only dealing with the third foundation, mind and mental states. So over the past month or so, I set myself to becoming mindful of my own mind in order to make this third foundation a lived practice. And from reading and from practicing, I have learned a few things. The sutta uses the Pali word citta to refer to mind, consciousness, and mental states. But citta also is sometimes translated as heart mind, giving a sense that consciousness, mind, is not limited just to head, but takes in emotions as well. To learn about the third foundation, then we become mindful of the mind itself and all its states, those mental states, and that includes emotions. So here are the two most important things that I learned for myself. I could stop the talk after I say these two things. I won't. You're going to have to listen to the rest. So the first thing I learned is mindfulness of mind is actually simple. Like a lot of our practices, not easy, but quite simple. What you were guided in tonight was guidance in mindfulness of mind. The second thing I learned was that the essence of the third foundation of mindfulness is to notice two things, what's present, and what became especially important to me, what is absent. And I'll say more about that later. So how do we become mindful of our own mind? Well, this is one of those simple but not easy instructions from Thich Nhat Hanh. If you want to know your own mind, there is only one way, to observe and recognize everything about it. This must be done at all times, during your day-to-day life, no less than during your hour of meditation. And I know you all spend an hour meditating. The basic instruction is simple, and you've heard it before. You must meet and be with your mind, dispassionately observing yourself. Dispassionately. For instance, Thich Nhat Hanh says, when a feeling or thought arises, your intention should not be to chase it away, or worry about it, or hate it, or be frightened by it, but simply acknowledge its presence. A feeling of sadness is arisen in me. A feeling of sadness is still present in me. No judgment, no criticism, no opinion, none of this is added to our feelings or thoughts, and no hurrying onward to the next experience, being with what is here now. Simply observing their coming and going. In this way, every mind state is treated on an absolutely equal basis. No favoritism, no enemies. So sometimes we have difficult mind states. We treat every difficult state gently, respectfully. States, and for me these are hard ones, states like embarrassment, shame, confusion. Not resisting even those states, but living with it in the moment that it's present. And we treat the wonderful mind states gently as well. States like peace or interest or joy. Not grabbing them, but just living calmly with each one in the moment that it's here. And as I was, doing my best to encourage you during the guidance, we must remember that meditation, mindfulness, is not a drowsy, semi-conscious state. That's what I call the movie-watching state. Thich Nhat Hanh says, in meditation, we should be as awake as if we are walking on stilts. So think about that. Each step is awareness. This is not an escape from reality to watch the mind. It is an active, calm encounter with reality, in fact, with all the realities of our mind. And why do we make this effort to see the mind and the mind states? It's because the ability to see and live peacefully with all aspects of mind is a liberating practice. And it brings wholeness and authenticity into our personalities. In the Buddhist time, and still today, the Indian practice of meditation, some of you may be familiar with like Kriya Yoga, those kinds of practices. That practice is to find the Atman, the core self that is somewhere in our inner life. But the Buddhist teaching took self out of the center of inner life. Through his teaching, what comes into view is not a self, but the mind. We begin to see the mind as a succession of mental events, the body as a stream of arising and passing experience. And then we see how very impermanent the mind is. And because we see the mind changing moment by moment under our very gaze, we begin to realize it cannot be taken as I or myself. So that brings up the problem of identification. Mental states are qualities of mind, emotions, thoughts, these longer-lasting moods that color our moments of consciousness. When practicing mindfulness of mind, we see mental states arise due to all kinds of conditions of body, of feeling tone, of environment. Our challenge is to experience every mental state that arises without identifying with it. But we identify so easily. What's the difference between experiencing a sensation or a thought or a feeling and identifying with it? It's like this. Restlessness is happening. I am restless. Confusion is present. I'm confused. Peacefulness is known. I am peaceful. The first is recognition. The second is identification. Identifying is creating a self, I, that is having or possessing the experience of the moment. The antidote to this is just to notice the object, confusion, restlessness, peacefulness, and notice, turn the attention from that to the perception of self arising, of I coming into the picture, seeing that the simple awareness of, say, irritation is not the same as turning into a subject who owns the irritation, a me. I am irritated. Why do we do this? Why do we identify? I think it's because we believe we need a me to hold a mental state. According to Shaila Catherine, in the scripture, the Buddha comments how rapidly mental states and mind change, so quickly that the Buddha himself could not even come up with a simile describing their speed. And he was good with similes. Shaila warns, we may identify with the mind state. I've seen this happen with me. She said, we may identify with the mind state. I am angry. But by the time we identify with the anger, the mind state of anger has passed away. Moods change. Nothing changes as fast as mood or mind. So with practice in mindfulness of mind, we learn to see that mental states arise and pass away, and that we can see them without needing to get involved with them. And when we don't take these mental states so personally, we relax in their presence and we just recognize them. The Dhammapada says, there is no fire like lust, no grip like anger, no net like delusion. The basic teaching of the third foundation is especially to know greed, hatred, and delusion in our own mind, and to know the absence of greed, the absence of hatred, and the absence of delusion in our mind. Why? Why is this important? Because when we become familiar with what these so-called defilements look like in our own field of mindfulness, we are not threatened when they appear. We are free to watch them arising with kind interest and to calmly see them passing. But Joseph Goldstein observes, this is difficult for Westerners. He said, we tend to see unwholesome mind states and quickly move from seeing it to blaming ourselves for having it or thinking we're a bad person just because the state is present. This reaction leads to a pattern of judging, self-aversion, of suffering. But with practice, you can see greed, hate, delusion in your own mind without such reactivity. Then we understand which mind states are skillful and lead to happiness and should be cultivated, and which states are unskillful and lead to suffering and should be abandoned. So we recognize unwholesome states. We don't indulge in them or deny them. We just know them. That's that simple recognition. It can be helpful to know that these states are not native to the mind, meaning they're not hardwired in. We're talking before we started the group tonight about the interest we have in the brain, neuroplasticity, and neurology. These qualities are not wired into our brains. We acquire them, and we can disacquire them as well. We can abandon them. The Buddha says these states come and go like visitors to the mind. So Thich Nhat Hanh says any of these unwholesome states are not a problem and they're not a mistake. They are simply part of the path, part of the path. And they are impermanent and selfless. He said simply be mindful when they're present and when they're not. And this is important because if we cannot see the presence of unwholesome states, we will simply act them out. And if we can't see their absence, then we will not recognize our own mind's capability for liberation. Our own capability for liberation. And about this, Joseph says something really encouraging. He says, we do not need to be free of defilements or hindrances to proceed in our practice. Mindfulness of all these states is itself the path to freedom. Through bare attention and mirror-like wisdom, we see their ephemeral, impermanent, and here's that word again, selfless nature. That itself is sufficient for liberation. So simply knowing the mind and its states is what leads us to liberation. The essence of all this observation is to know when the mind is affected by greed, hate, delusion, the defilements, and when it is not. When it is not, for me, this was a crucial understanding. Seeing the mind when it is free of unwholesome mental states, then we understand what a balanced mind feels like, not pushed or pulled around. Joseph reminds us, we notice the mind's ease and purity when we are aware, without clinging, without condemning, without judging, just aware, even if what we're aware of is some negative state in the mind. Then we experience liberation, as one Tibetan teacher described, in short moments, many times. That's what it seemed like to me when I began to work with mindfulness of mind. After taking on this practice, I was surprised to discover there were many times during the day when my mind was just free of desire, anger, delusion, just happy, at ease. And it was there already. No extra work, no hours in secluded meditation. Just put a new filter on mindfulness to see when difficulty is not present. And then recognize what is present, what the Buddha calls luminous mind, characterized by joy, delight, equanimity. These short moments of liberation are available to me and to you many times. So the third foundation of mindfulness of mind, is not about avoiding thought. Assuming that thought is a distraction and we're better off just paying attention to our breath or the body sensations, mindfulness has no preferred object. When thinking arises, we bring mindfulness directly to the thoughts, to the mind itself, working away. Oh, there's deduction. Oh, there's speculation. Oh, memory, story, oh, revenge, daydream, plan, judgment, rehearsal, decision. The experience of knowing the mind itself at work. We notice a thought's quality of wholesome, meaning the thought leads toward happiness, or the thought might be unwholesome, meaning the thought leads toward unhappiness, toward suffering. Thich Nhat Hanh says, don't dwell on a thought or try to get rid of it, however much you don't like it. I might discover myself judging a friend and not liking myself for that. I can simply say, oh, judging is present. Judging is being known. When a wholesome thought arises, just acknowledge it. This is a wholesome thought. When an unwholesome thought arises, just acknowledge it. An unwholesome thought has arisen in me. For instance, a wholesome thought might be, oh, I'm going to share my meal with her. That's a thought of generosity. Oh, that's a generous thought. Generosity is present. Or I might say, I'm not going to pitch in and help. And I might get, oh, that is not generous. That is an unwholesome thought. No blame, no opinion, no criticism. Noticing. To acknowledge is enough. Ajahn Sumedho suggests something that at first seems kind of funny, but it's actually very useful. He says, listen to your thoughts as if you were listening to your neighbor on the other side of the fence gossiping away. Well, we did this, and he said that, and I can't believe that she went and did that. This is that just rambling quality of thought, inner narration. We all have it. It's just a condition the human mind has, he says, to ramble on. It is not a person doing that. It's not a self doing it. That's pretty surprising. the rambling mind. I don't have to be responsible for that. I can direct it, but I don't have to blame myself over it. And he says, Ajahn Sumedho says, the idea is you pay attention and make these thoughts really conscious in order to see them rather than to believe them. Because when you watch such trivial, obsessive thoughts going to their absurd conclusions, you can laugh a bit and just see how seriously you're taking yourself. Way too seriously. That is the way you learn to see each thought, each train of thought, and the habits of thought that we live with many times unconsciously, maybe most times unconsciously. And we learn that a thought is just another condition of mind that comes and goes. It's just one of those factors. It arises, it passes. So finally, with a little practice, you find that you are able to look at a thought and see the emptiness in which it arises and the emptiness into which it fades, the space around the thought. We can be in such a habit of busy thinking, repetitive thinking, constant thinking, and never see mind without thought. Indeed, the spaces around thought, between thoughts, are there. The mind itself, luminous mind. So here are some, what I think are some skillful practices about seeing mind and mind states. These are things you can do. I've done them over this past month, and they're really very useful, I think. One of the things is we often overlook the presence of wholesome states of mind. Reminds me of Rick Hansen, who talks about how we hardwire our brain for happiness. We often overlook these wholesome states, like happiness, like joy, interest, pleasure. Here's an exercise to try, and I did this just recently. When you feel a strong wanting, a desire for something, whatever it is, doesn't really matter. Be mindful what that desire feels like in mind and body. In my case, it was an item in a gift shop. I was in the museum, and I saw this really pretty scarf, and I thought, oh, I could wear that to Sangha, and I would look so nice. And I picked it up and looked at the price tag, and it was $130. And I thought, I can't do that. But, oh, my God, my heart was beating, my hands were sweaty, and I thought, I could do that. I could. And I realized, this is real. Classic desire. I was actually getting breathless over this. And I just, you know, I let it roll because this was my practice. And I thought, isn't that interesting? It's just a bunch of threads. And here I am hyperventilating over this thing. So when that happens to you, and it will, it'll be a new car or it'll be a cup of coffee, whatever it is, just be mindful what that feels like, mind and body, and then watch as it disappears. It might disappear suddenly, or it might disappear over time. When it's gone, if you're in meditation, don't rush back to the breath. If you're going about your daily life, as I was, don't rush on to some new task, but pay attention to the mind free of wanting. That relief, the desire is gone. Peace, space, the mind is spacious again. Here's another thing that I kind of just learned within the past year. Be careful of categories. I mean, I've heard this, but I understood it this past year. Last year in June, I went to a Zen retreat, and the Roshi, Greg Myers, ended each day with a very short instruction, like one-sentence instruction every night. And one night, his very emphatic instruction was, do not have categories. And I didn't know why he said that. And I'm beginning to understand it now. It is, I think, and I'm pretty sure this is what he meant, when we categorize something in our experience, we put it into a box of our own making. And that box, the walls of that box, keep out any other possibilities. So we see somebody coming toward us, and here's a category. He's a jerk. I don't want to talk to him. I've put him in a category. She never finishes a job. Somebody offers to do something for me, and my category is she's a person who never finishes a job. Here's another category. I heard someone say this about herself in jail Friday. I'm stupid. Now there is a box. Gil Fronsdahl says it is the habit of the mind to categorize, to generalize. It's like shorthand for the mind. But he says, keep particularizing. See each experience as it is, not forcing it to fit our assumptions. In other words, the box is he's a jerk. The particularization is, here comes John, and let's see what happens. Period. No judgment, no criticism of John or my relationship with him. She offers to do a job for me. The box is, she never finishes a job. The removal of the boxes, let's see what happens this time. I'm stupid. There's the box. What's the removal of that box? That could be kind of complicated. It might be going back and seeing the voice in my own mind that is telling me I'm stupid. Is it my big sister's voice? That's who it was for this woman in the jail. I asked her, whose voice do you hear when that comes to you? She said, oh, my sister. She told me that my whole childhood. And she said, that can never change, can it? And I said, it just did. Because you're seeing who's saying it to you. Your sister. Is she here? No. Are you a little girl anymore? No. It was like the box fell over. And daylight came in. Luminous mind. So here's another thing that can be very useful. Become aware of background moods or emotions in daily life. So it's important to realize that emotions and moods are what we most personalize and identify with. So often we go through our day unconsciously influenced by some certain mood. Without even being aware it's present, the mood becomes a filter on our experience. At these times, we are looking through the world through colored glasses, seeing everything through the lenses of, say, fearfulness or infatuation or fogginess. But as we practice mindfulness of mind, we may notice more clearly what mood is present that is coming up with every experience we have during this day. And then we see how it is coloring every experience, coloring our mind events. When we are mindful of the presence of this mood, then, it may or may not lift, but without adding a sense of self to this mood, oh, I am fearful, we can simply know, oh, fearful mind is like this. Fearful mind sees a new experience and doesn't want to do it. And then we might see, oh, the exuberant mind is like this. The exuberant mind wants to do everything and is excited and loud and jumpy. We see it, and then we can change or modify our activities accordingly if we need to. Here's another thing. Sometimes we have a mental struggle in meditation or in life, and we don't really even feel clear about what's going on. We just feel a lack of ease. We feel full of effort, full of striving, no inner peace. Feelings of struggle tell us that something is going on that we are not accepting. Because if we're accepting, we wouldn't be struggling. So when this sense of struggle arises, sit back, open up awareness, and simply ask this question, what is happening? And be open for the answer. Don't be pushing away what is willing to come up. You might find that underlying this struggle is some angry story feeding it, or a fear about the future that you haven't been willing to bring into awareness, or a sad memory. That's what's really happening. And when you can see what's really present, you get in touch with your own authenticity, your own reality, and that brings relief. When you're better able to acknowledge and accept just what this is, the mind no longer struggles against it. And of course, like all of our practice, there is a moral aspect to this, because both wholesome and unwholesome thoughts and mind states motivate our actions and influence how we act in the world. That is why we make this effort and work to see and work skillfully with their influence on our mind and in our life. So I want to end with a saying of the Buddha. O nobly born, do not forget the luminous nature of your own mind. Return to it. Trust it. It is your home.